You are listening to episode number 52 of the Effective Statistician Podcast, an introduction to benefit risk assessment. Welcome to the Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector designed to improve your leadership skills, widen your business acumen, and enhance your efficiency. The PSI conference in London is coming up. It's from the 2nd to the 5th of June in London, as I said. And if you listen to this very, very timely, you can still catch the early bird rate because it ends on March 20th of 2019. I've already registered and I will also present there. So come join me at the conference. It'll be awesome. I have made so many, many good connections at this conference. It's great for networking. It's great from a content perspective. It's actually the best conference for pharma statisticians or for CRO statisticians that I have ever been to, and have been to quite some conferences. It's very, very to the point, very practical, no kind of ivory tower statistics. It's really what will help you. Lots of very, very good content. And you know, there has been so many abstract submissions that the acceptance rate was, I think, about 50%. Can you believe it? Most of the conference actually struggle to fill all their slots. The PSI conference can actually select the best conference for you as a participant. So act fast and save the early bird deadline. So register now and let's meet in London. In this episode, we talk about benefit risk. This is a topic very, very close to my heart. I have been the chair of the benefit risk SIG for quite some time. And today we talk about what benefit risk assessment is, what the role of you as a statistician is in that there. We do dive into the benefit risk landscape because not only statisticians are, of course, working in this. And we also will tell you a little bit about the special interest group on benefit risk and how you can become a member and what it offers for you also if you're not a member. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. And this time it's really, really nice because I'm speaking with two friends of mine that I have worked with for a very, very long time on the topic of this episode, benefit risk. And we have as guests here today, Maria and Sherul, and it's only me as a host because Benjamin couldn't make it for this date. So, hi, Maria. How are you doing?
Hello, Alexander. I'm very good. Thank you.
Hi, Sherul. How are you?
Hello, Alexander. I'm good. Thank you. Hello. So, okay. Maria.
Hi, Sherul.
Okay, very good. So, before we dive into the topic itself, Maria, Sherul, maybe you can introduce yourself first and tell us a little bit about your experience with benefit risk assessment and why you think it's important for you.
Okay, maybe I can start. So, as you know, my name is Maria Costa. I'm a statistician at Novartis, and I've been very interested in this topic for some time now, since essentially joining the pharmaceutical industry. I've worked in company initiatives on the topic of benefit risk. I am part of the FSPI PSI SIG, and I'm also part of the DIA benefit risk subteam. I have published papers with several colleagues on this topic, particularly related to the application of Bayesian thinking into benefit risk. So I've collaborated with Alexander and Sharul on several initiatives, particularly as part of the FSPI PSI 6. So I find this topic really relevant for myself as a statistician in the pharmaceutical industry, because as statisticians, whenever we gather data from our the clinical trials we are involved in, we always find ourselves with the question of what are the relevant trade-offs between the observed data on our efficacy endpoints and any potential safety risks. And I think the clinical teams, HTA members, etc., they always turn to the statistician for help to on how to interpret the data, on how to visualize the data, etc. So I think that as a statistician in the pharmaceutical industry, it is really our job to enable teams to make this assessment as clear and as transparent as it can be.
Okay, awesome. And why are you passionate about it?
Because I think that all the questions that are related to the interpretation of data from clinical trials are all associated with this trade-off. So very often the drugs we work in have or we observe potential safety signals. But we know that, of course, patients are in need of treatments to that can address their main concerns with the disease that they have. And so it's really all about this trade-off. Okay, so I, you know, I can benefit if I take this drug, I can have this list of benefits. However, it is there is a potential that I might experience some of these safety risks. And then the benefit risk assessment really helps you make this trade-off clear and transparent and help so that patients and physicians and not just sponsors, but can make informed decisions. So I think once the clinical trial data is collected, the interpretation of it is really all in the context of this trade-off. And I think that this is really critical for patients and among other stakeholders.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That all is also why, for me personally, it was always important, because I see this as a common topic across a complete development of a new product, from very, very early preclinical phases up to, you know, up to end of patent life and beyond. It stays relevant, and there are so many areas where we need to address this benefit risk question, and we'll go into these a little bit further down the line here. But it's really the key question that's always asked. And I think very often we as statisticians have focused just once on one side of the medal, and we have, you know, teams that look into just one side of the medal, and other teams that look at the other side of the medal. And the more I think about it, and the more I see that people are not connected to that question, to this bigger picture, the less well defined are the analysis, the less well thought through are the presentations. And I think that's then not optimally supporting good decisions. Okay, so turning to Sharul, please introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Alexander and Maria. I feel very much the same as both of you about benefit risk assessment. So just a short introduction, really. I am Sharul Matisa. I am a statistician in the HTA, Health Technology Assessment. I'm working for MSD in the UK. Prior to joining MSD, I was a clinical trial statistician at Imperial College London, where it was, I think, my first exposure two benefit risk assessments. I think it was probably my most fuller exposure to benefit risk assessment when I first encountered it.
Yeah, and of course you worked on quite interesting projects actually at the time. So maybe you can speak a little bit about these.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think in particular, my exposure was through the IMI Protect Work Package 5, which focused on the methodology of the benefit assessment for the regulatory submission. I was actually very much involved in the methodological work and case studies in IMI Protect that actually has actually grown on me over the years. So I think towards the end of the project, I know this is actually an area that I really want to pursue further, not just theoretically, but also in practice. So that's where basically what brought me to the industry. So at MSD, I actually co-lead the Benefit Risk Assessment Initiative in the company, in which we explore available methodologies and look at different guidelines for implementation using our products. And within our group, we are not only actually looking at what is available out there, but we are also interested in the more complex issues in benefit risk assessment. So we do this by, of course, conducting further research internally and also through external collaborations.
Okay, very, very good. Thanks so much, Sharul and Maria. Mm-hmm. And we covered already a little bit of what benefit risk assessment actually is in the introductions. And Maria told very, very nicely why we as statisticians need to be really key and involved in there. And I think that is also why the benefit risk special interest group was founded in the first place a couple of years ago. And there's lots of material on the benefit risk group out there. But I think, Maria, maybe you can go a little bit deeper into the topic of why we as statisticians need to be involved in benefit risk assessments.
No, sure. And actually, as you were talking about it before, I was thinking, you know, I think our role as statisticians in the industry we work in, from my perspective at least, I see it as really expanding, particularly in the last few years. And there are many opportunities for statisticians to be involved, not just at the design stage, not just, as you mentioned, Alexander, in the analysis of the efficacy data, but really, I think there are many opportunities for statisticians to sit at the table and really be involved in the key discussions, in a cross-functional team. And I think particularly when it comes to benefit risk, you know, clinical trials obviously are typically designed to address maybe one, maybe more than one scientific question of interest. But in the end, we all know that many things happen during the course of the trial that, you know, we as sponsors, we can't really control for. And so the data that you collect at the end of your trial may not be perfect to address the key questions. There is always uncertainty, and uncertainty from my perspective is the business of statisticians. You know, we are experts in understanding uncertainty and quantifying it. And I think this becomes particularly relevant when you are talking about benefit risk and the trade-offs between efficacy and safety. And I think in addition to looking into uncertainty, the other aspect of benefit risk where I think statisticians really have a key role to play is in developing visualizations that can help not only the team to understand the data, but really also to communicate the benefit-risk trade-off besides the team, be it, for example, internally in your companies or when you go outside externally to your companies, to regulatory agencies, HTA bodies, etc. So I think that beyond interpreting the data, there is the element of describing the uncertainty in your data and also enabling teams to visualize the data in an effective way. So I think there is a lot of research involving statisticians in all of these topics. And I'm sure Alexander will probably come to that at some point in this podcast.
Yeah, there's actually one additional thing that I'm very, very often step over in that part, and that is the correlation of endpoints. So if I think there's very often you have a number of efficacy endpoints that are highly correlated to each other, and then you have a couple of safety endpoints that are vaguely or not at all correlated to each other. But if you know, if you just put them all next to each other, it looks like you have 10 very, very significant efficacy endpoints where you have big differences, and you have 5 safety signals which are kind of vague. And if you don't take into account the correlations, you may just get the perception that there's a huge benefit on the efficacy side. And in reality, you basically double count things or triple or even more count things, just word them differently and with different tools that are highly correlated.
Yeah, I'm happy that you mentioned that because, as you may know, as part of my work on this topic, I've looked into Bayesian models that account or try to account for any potential correlation between efficacy and safety, such that, as you mentioned, you can actually make a more efficient and correct and transparent assessment of any potential trade-off. So that is something I feel really passionate about. And again, I think there are opportunities there for statisticians to really be driving those discussions with their teams.
The other point is, I think we as statisticians with our mathematical background are really trained to structure the problem in such a way that it can be easily discussed, and introduce language and introduce words so that everybody really talks about the same things. And you structure the overall problem in such a way with benefit risk that you can actually tackle it very well. And I think that's another strength of statisticians. Actually, one of the reasons that I discussed a couple of times with senior leaders about benefit risk is that the reason that statisticians fail is that they don't get the seat at the table that you just mentioned. But as you said, I think that is expanding, and more statisticians are putting more efforts into their leadership skills to have the opportunity to sit at these tables and do exactly what you just described. Sharul, do you want to add something to that?
I very much echo what you and Maria said. I think this area really provides us with a lot of opportunities statistically, because I think for the reasons, really, it is a fairly new area. And the statistics that we use in benefit risk assessments are still in development. They are still being argued. There's really nothing there that really acceptable to everyone. And also, of course, we have the development in other areas of statistics as well, and also the development in the other disease areas as well, that would, of course, I think, affect the way we conduct benefit risk assessment. Yeah, so I think that the a lot of things there actually very related, and benefit risk assessment itself is a very big area.
Yeah, in terms of this big area, let's touch on a couple of different situations where you can actually apply benefit risk methodology. So we touched on kind of the regulatory interactions, but what are other situations that you would apply these things?
So I guess maybe I can start. I think it is, you know, if you find yourself in the lucky scenario, I would argue that you have, you know, a very clear positive signal in your efficacy data and no difference versus your comparator in terms of your safety endpoints, you know, you don't need very complex assessments for benefit risk to determine that, you know, this drug is really doing what it should be doing with no additional burden from a safety perspective to the patient. However, from my experience, at least, more often than not, we will find ourselves in a scenario where you have, you know, maybe you have met your primary endpoint. However, some of the secondary endpoints that are important to fully characterize your drug are, you know, the signal is not quite clear cut. The improvements over your comparator are not clinically meaningful potentially. And in addition to that, maybe, you know, there is some concerns about potential safety signals. In those circumstances, I would argue that it is important to really dig deeper into the extent of benefit versus the extent of risk to really quantify the uncertainty there. So this will be a situation where I think that a structured benefit risk assessment and even a quantitative benefit risk assessment could really help the teams. And I think these are situations, you know, we hear a lot about preference, the concept of preference in drug development, patient preference, etc. And regulatory agencies are working as we speak on this topic. And I think that when you find yourself in a situation where the choice between treatment A or treatment B is preference sensitive, this is also where structured formal benefit risk assessments can be very useful.
In terms of that, I think, you know, if you have two drugs that you compare to each other, that's a classic scenario. And if you have just one drug that you compare to the placebo, that's also a classic scenario. I think it's also relevant if you look, for example, into different doses of the same drug. And you want to assess kind of if the higher dose better than the lower dose. And that is, you know, very nicely, very often represents a typical case for benefit risk assessment, because the higher dose may be more efficacious, but also carry more risks. And this is exactly where, you know, you need to have a very good benefit risk assessment to come up with the argument of why you want to go for one or the other. And I think there's lots of situations where there was a disagreement on this topic. And if you don't have, you know, structured the problem in a nice way, it's very, very difficult to disentangle this disagreement and see where really kind of the problems are.
And it's interesting because, you know, we hear that so many drugs fail in the late stages of development because of the, I mean, potentially wrong dose. Or if they do succeed, you then have, you know, post-marketing commitments or post-marketing studies to actually fine-tune the dose. So I think we should not underestimate at all the benefit-risk element of choosing dose at the end of your phase 2B studies.
Speaking about that, I think we can speak about from a design perspective about benefit-risk, but we can also think about, you know, different situations across the life cycle of a product. Shirul, what do you think are there the different situations where benefit risk becomes important?
I think benefit risk assessment is important, and it is important in basically every situation. I think, like Maria mentioned earlier, it is probably more required for a structured benefit risk assessment when you observe something that is not really clear cut. So when we have something that's already clear, then whether the benefits outweigh the risk, then it does not matter anymore whether we go for a full benefit risk assessment. In terms of the life cycle of the product, the methodologies would not change. I think what would change is the focus, the decisions to be made, and how much resources that we actually need to put into the benefit risk assessment itself. I think the key point to these assessments is that we are transparent in the decisions that we reach, that we can actually document them and defend our decision based on what available evidence at the time. I think on this point, I am actually glad that the European Medicines Agency actually adopted the use of effects table as part of their marketing authorization assessment. And this is a good milestone, and pharmaceutical companies really do need to get up to speed with regularly creating and incorporating the effects table in, of course, our assessments and also our submissions to the regulators.
Yeah, and I think the effects table is a nice tool that you can use throughout your life cycle.
That's correct.
Of your drug. You can basically start with that very, very early in your development, maybe even in preclinical phases. Of course, then it will have kind of different items in it in terms of, you know, tox ranges and whether it's actually reaching the target, and it will probably have a lot of also qualitative aspects in it. But there you can basically capture in a very, very condensed way what are the pros and cons of the drug, together with the variations that you have for these things. And if you have, if you work on a specific disease area, within this disease area, maybe that isn't that much changing. And then, you know, if you need to screen a lot of different compounds, then you can have one set of kind of ways that you look at these compounds and screen through these compounds. And I think that, you know, will develop over the life cycle of the product or over the kind of different stages of the product. In phase one, you will have, you know, a little bit of a different effects table, but maybe very, very similar for the different for a given disease state again. And then that more and more moves into the dosing decision, into the phase three decision, into the regulatory decision, into the HTA decision, and then, in, you know, up to the point where basically physicians and patients talk about it. And so, or there's a reassessment from the regulators in terms of whether the safety signal has changed. So in terms of the now we call it periodic benefit risk updates. So throughout the complete life cycle of the drug, there are lots of key decisions to be made, and these are very often benefit risk decisions. Now, we talked a lot about kind of different ways and of benefit risk, and you used words like structured benefit risk and more complex benefit risk and these kind of words. Maria, maybe you can speak a little bit to that. What do you mean by qualitative, quantitative, structured complex benefit risk assessment.
Sure. Actually, I was thinking, as Sharul was mentioning, effects tables, that again, the statisticians shouldn't really be shy in terms of educating the teams they work with in those tools if those teams are not familiar with them. So effects tables as and other, let's say, frameworks are what we would call potentially qualitative frameworks for benefit risk assessment. And the idea behind these qualitative frameworks is to help frame the problem. So what is the question that we want to address? Once you frame the problem, what are the key drivers for the decision-making process, or you could say the key endpoints? And then once you have that identified as well, these qualitative frameworks can help you, can help make clear what are potential deficiencies in your data. So, for example, if there are imbalances in terms of missing data of some kind or in terms of specific intercurrent events of interest, these qualitative frameworks can really help you, you know, put all of that together, make it clear. This is the question, this is the framework, this is, you know, the data that can help us answer that question.
And in terms of the effects table, we talked a couple of times about that. For those that actually don't know what it is, it basically captures all the key benefits and risks for your drug compared to a relevant comparator. That could be, you know, placebo or another drug, or it could be different doses, in one bigger table. And it describes for each of these endpoints the variation, could be confidence intervals or something like this. And this is very often table, but also very often a graph. With, you know, that looks very similar to a forest plot, and it, sometimes it goes both goes together, and as you can add notes to it, and there's actually quite a lot of examples on different effects tables out there. So, and I think the key thing is it looks very, very easy, but it's not that easy to get to such a easy interpretation of the overall data, because there can be lots of arguments about how you display these kind of things, how what is the important endpoints that you need to include. So I think the just getting to this effects table is already quite an interesting experience, because it will highlight all the key discussions that you have. That's a qualitative approach, yeah.
And I was going to add to that, and I think often so obviously the framework itself is very useful, but as you mentioned, the discussions that the team has in order to get to a final effects table, I think that probably they are even more useful in a way, because it's an opportunity for the team to really you know, get to the bottom of their data, really understand the potential and the deficiencies of their data, etc., and feel confident in communicating that. So I think qualitative frameworks are a really important, if not, you know, crucial first step to any benefit risk assessment. And if you apply these frameworks, these qualitative frameworks, this is what we would call a structured benefit risk assessment, the first step in that, because it really helps you structure your thinking. So once you have that, you can then move forward, if there is a need, to what is typically called a quantitative benefit risk assessment. And there are a variety of methods out there, and Sharul, as part of your work with IMI Protect, you guys did a very exhaustive and comprehensive assessment of a number of these tools for quantitative benefit risk assessment. And the idea is really to then try and quantify this trade-off between benefits and risks somehow, be it, for example, through a benefit risk score or a benefit risk ratio or a probability statement. There are a variety of tools. They all obviously have advantages and disadvantages, depending on the question you have at hand or the data that you have collected. But this is, I would say, this is the key difference. But maybe, Sharul, you can speak through your experience as part of IMI.
Yes, no, I think our understanding, perfectly match. So that's a good thing. I think in Protect as well, we also went a little bit further, and we also defined what we call as the fully quantitative benefit risk assessment, which then starts to take into account of the different perspective or different patient preferences or the decision makers' preferences into the assessment, and then eventually puts everything together to trade off the benefits and risk. So that's, I think, another probably another terminology that I think we would like to introduce here as well. So I think in terms of the chronology, we would have a qualitative as the first step, and then you can go a little bit further to a quantitative assessment. And then if you are in a very complex decision making situation, then you would go for a fully quantitative benefit risk assessment, which would be the most exhaustive method to use.
One thing I would add to that is that I think it's important to highlight the fact that all of these approaches are really there to support teams in making the decision.
That's correct.
But will not make the decision on behalf of the team.
Yep.
So, you know, you make your benefit risk assessment. It really is just a tool to support you and not to replace the clinical judgment.
Yeah, and I think that is a very, very important thing. It's not kind of a black box data in decision out kind of thing. In terms of the quantitative approach, I think if you break it down to, let's say, a very, very simple thing, you have two drugs that you compare to each other. One drug is more efficacious than the other, but also carries more risk. And now the question, of course, is what's more important, the treatment benefit or the risk difference? And where the preferences come in is they tell you, they can give you weights in terms of the trade-offs that you need to make, the trade-off between the efficacy side and the safety side. And there's tools that Sharul alluded to that help you to do that if you have even more than just these two endpoints, if you have multiple endpoints, that you can come up with an overall weighting of these different endpoints so that you basically can match them all onto a single outcome. Actually, you know, from a medical point of view, we often see that as being quite difficult. But in the end, we are doing these kind of things in our head all the time. So if we, let's say, buy a car and we need to select between different cars that have different features, different prices, we do the same thing. Yeah, we have pros and cons, and we try to match everything to the same unit, maybe, you know, euros or pound or dollars, and then we make our decision in the end. So, and there, of course, our personal preferences play a big role. Yeah, so family, maybe a big car is more important than a powerful car. And I think the same holds true here for the medical situations. I just want to make sure that, this is not seen as something that is kind of obscure or non-intuitive. it's actually something that we intuitively do anyway. And I think these tools help us to quantify things, to make it transparent, explicit, and that really we have a terminology to talk about these kind of things. So that is really, really important. And we talked already about Protect a couple of times. There's lots. Protect is kind of one area where you can find a lot of sources on that. But of course, there's lots of different parties that actually have worked on this benefit risk topic, because obviously it's not just a statistical topic. Sharul, what are all the other, you know, parties, work streams, and so on that have worked on this topic?
There are quite a lot, actually. If I can remember on top of my head, we have a work package on real-world evidence, a work package on pharmacovigilance, and benefit risk assessment, of course. And I think it is a collaboration between several pharmaceutical companies, multiple regulators as well as academia. So it is a big collaboration. I think it was over 5 years project. So there are a lot of outputs actually from Protect itself. So I think in the end, what we really want to achieve through Protect is that to see how are all these different areas actually come together for the purpose of the assessing the benefits and risks of a product. So it is a big collaboration. Yes.
In terms of that is IMI Protect, mm-hmm. but there's lots of other kind of groups beyond IMI's Protect that work on this. Can you maybe mention a couple of the important
yes.
ones?
Yes. So I think follow on from the Protect work, there is currently now an IMI consortium on vaccines benefit risk monitoring. So the one's called IMI Advanced. I believe the consortium is changing its name to VAC for EU. So it's VAC for EU. So I think from now on, it's going to be called that. And of course, there is the new IMI project on patient preference called the IMI Prefer.
Prefer.
Yeah. So that's the one as well. So I think these are the two main ones that focus very much on benefit risk assessment. But there is. If we are also aware, there is the IMI EU2P, which provides training and so on, which also has a component of benefit risk assessment in their curriculum.
And then we also have a couple of kind of, on the other side of the ocean, a couple of initiatives as well. Maria, maybe you can talk to these a little bit.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm not sure if I know all of them, but I was just thinking the DIA Bayesian Scientific Working Group has a sub-team looking into benefit risk. And obviously, you know, PSI together with FSPI also have a special interest group. The other thing I wanted to bring, and this maybe it's more related to the topic of patient preference and the link to benefit risk assessment, but other organizations that maybe are not that familiar to statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry, such as ISPOR, for example, they have explored some of these topics as maybe sometimes in other contexts. But I think if you want to learn about the topic from a very general perspective, you can maybe extend your field beyond the standard, if you like, pharmaceutical area. So, Absolutely.
And ISPO has written two position papers on that. If you search for MCDA, multi-criteria decision analysis, then you will find these things. There's very often this term MCDA is used in association with quantitative benefit risk assessments.
It's interesting, you know, because actually now we mentioned the concept of preference, patient preference or stakeholder preference a few times in this conversation. But what I find is that when you speak to colleagues that maybe come from a slightly different background, you know, colleagues that are maybe more involved with ISPO, with other areas that are nothing to do with life sciences, it's interesting how we seem at times to speak a different language, but actually we are talking about the same things. We just use maybe a slightly different terminology. So I think it is really an opportunity for you to stretch yourself and to see things from a different perspective and to and try to understand how you can learn from them, if there is anything to be learned that you can incorporate into your day to day, and vice versa. It's been a very interesting ride.
In terms of that, actually, we now used a couple of acronyms. We used a couple of resources and mentioned them here. We'll put links to all these different materials into the show notes. So just go into the show notes after you have listened to this, and then you can find lots of links and further readings. Maria, you just mentioned the ESPI, PSI, Benefit Risk Special Interest Group. And you mentioned you are part of that. Actually, you're chairing it.
Yes.
Now, after I handed this over to you. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about this special interest group and actually what it's doing.
Sure. Actually, this is really, I mean, my journey into benefit risk has been, I find, an interesting one, maybe not so obvious, but because when I started being involved in that special interest group, I wasn't really that aware. It was at the beginning of my career in the pharmaceutical industry, and I didn't really have that much experience, insight into that topic, particularly as I was very much working in early development at the time. But in any way, fast forward a few years, my interest in this area grew a lot. And to be honest, Alexander, I don't actually remember how I got to join the special interest group, but maybe, you know, that's for another conversation. So we are a group of statisticians. I would say now that we actually come from very different, we bring a lot of different experiences, different backgrounds. We have people who come maybe from more the safety side of things, people that come more from a post-marketing side of drug development. And now we even have colleagues that come from outside drug development. So I think the group has really expanded, and brings a lot of really interesting discussions. Our remit is really to explore and advance the field of benefit risk applied to drug development. Not necessarily just late phase, but, you know, in all areas of the drug development pathway. The aim is really to contribute to shape this area and learn from each other and teach others, if there is an opportunity to do that. And I would make a very shameless shout out to the upcoming course we are organizing as part of the PSI conference. So if you are planning to attend this year's PSI conference, which starts on the 2nd of June in London, then we will be organizing a half-day course on preference elicitation. You know, we've mentioned it here a few times, and I think that is because this topic is getting really, really a lot of traction within drug development, within companies particularly. And regulatory agencies, and I'm thinking particularly the FDA, is about to release 5 to 6 guidances on the topic. I think the EMA has also been exploring this topic, and so we feel that it is time for statisticians to be up to speed on what is a preference, how to elicit preferences, how to use the outcome from such an elicitation to support decision-making, for example, in terms of benefit risk. So it's all about empowering statisticians to get a seat at the table where it matters.
Yeah, it's actually an awesome thing. There were a couple of presentations on these in the last PSI meetings. So in Berlin, London last time, in Amsterdam, we all had sessions dedicated to benefit risk. And it's always a very, very interesting topic and something that often you don't learn so much in your standard academic career, and something that is really important and is increasingly getting importance. And it would be a shame if statisticians miss out on that and leave this area to other parts. And so come to this conference training that happens on the Sunday before the conference, and learn about that so that you can help to disentangle these situations where one choice is more efficacious and the other is more safe, and you can, you know, have methods at hand to elicitate these preferences so that you can make a quantitative benefit risk assessment. So that's very good. Sharul, do you want to add?
I actually just want to add something to the workshop. It's not all serious throughout. It is a serious topic, but we are going to be doing some role playing in there. So have a little bit of fun while we actually learn something.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun last time we did it.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay, very good. So with that said, I hope you have got a little bit of interest into the SIG. And now, of course, the question is, how can someone that is a listener now become a member of the SIG, Maria?
So, yes, of course, you can reach out to me. If you go to the PSI webpage, there is a tab around the different special interest groups. And if you click on the benefit risk one, you'll see my contact details there. So I can tell you that in the last year or so, we have had a number of new people joining that bring really interesting expertise. Obviously, the SIG is only as effective as the members that compose it. But I would say that we have a really interesting group of people. Sharul is part of it. And yeah, just send me an email and I'll be happy to have a chat with you and include you in our discussions moving forward.
Yep. And of course, all these links are also in the show notes. Okay. Thanks so much for the discussion. It was a pleasure again to chat with you about this topic that is really close to my heart. And actually, I just noticed, Maria, you're the first one that is the second time on the podcast.
Oh, yay!
Do you remember the last time you have been on the podcast?
I do remember. It was in Amsterdam. And yes, you caught me off guard. No, I'm kidding. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So if you want to listen to Maria, just scroll back on your player and find the episode about Best of PSI 2018. And I have a short interview with Maria in that. Okay, thanks so much. See you all in London for the course.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Alexander.
Thanks, Alexander. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you.
The show was created in association with PSI. Let's meet at the PSI conference. Thanks for listening. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector.